Welcome to Finding Your Identity, the podcast about helping you find your identity. Welcome back to Finding Your Identity. This is episode 17, and I'm Derek McKinney, your host. And I was just telling the YouTube viewers how they could get some free merch if they follow the instructions in the best way possible. So as a podcast listener, I encourage you to, after you listen to this episode all the way, go to the YouTube video and just watch the first few minutes. Or watch the whole thing again if you're just, you know, you want to see my face and the words coming out of my mouth. I should make a video where it's little like word clouds just kind of bubbling out as I talk, because that would just be mesmerizing. Probably not, but I'm going to say that you'll find out what I'm talking about if you go watch the video. So today, I'm going to talk about doing research and why I think it's important in many aspects of your life. So I know you just rolled your eyes. I could hear. So just hold on a second. Let me explain. It all makes sense in a minute. So why do I say that it's important? Because finding your identity has the word finding in it. And finding is researching. And researching is searching. And if you think about it, you gotta do something. If you're gonna try to find something, you gotta get out there. You gotta look around, you know, open your eyes, open your ears, open your nose. You know, you gotta just get out there. And so research, basically a synonym. So for all the stuff I was just saying. So I think that if you bear with me, I think you'll find this of value, because doing research isn't just something you do in college. And, you know, if you are in college, then you're like, hey, this is right up my alley. If you're not in college, you should be like, okay, how can I get this up my alley? Well, that sounded a little funny. But I think what you want is you want to look at it like, okay, I'm going to search for a new job. I got to do research. Hey, I'm going to go out and see if I want to do a new extracurricular activity. You know, what is it? Tennis, basketball at the park, whatever. Well, where do I go play basketball at the park? Which park? Oh, I got to go on Google Maps. What's the closest park? Oh, maybe I drive over to the park and I look and I see some guys and they're playing basketball. Hey, there you go. Now I'm aware, I've done some research, and I can say now I know where to go play some basketball at the park because these guys play on Sundays at 10 a.m. or whatever. More importantly, you're looking for a career, something that is going to be dramatically different than what you're doing. And you have the skill set behind it because maybe you went to school for it, or you did some kind of training program, certificate, what have you. But whatever that is, you don't necessarily just automatically know what job. I mean, unless you were basically groomed and walked through with your, you know, by your hand in some Ivy League school to the front doors of Goldman Sachs or something. That's a different story. But, you know, I think the rest of the population needs some kind of help, so, you know, and needs to actually take some responsibility in finding what their future is going to be. So I'd say, you know, you got to start figuring out where are good places to research stuff. Now, I can go down through a list easily, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to take you through what I find are good places to look for information, just from a general perspective. And what I mean by that is start with Google. Everything starts with Google, but it's not the end. It's not the end of the line. It's not the end of the research spectrum. So what you're doing by starting with Google is you're just saving yourself a little bit of the legwork. You know, you hopefully would think that it's going to get you started in the right place. But one of the things I think is really important when it comes to doing research is, you know, kind of verifying your sources. You know, what are you actually going to consider, you know, a good source is important, because it's not just something that you can just trust the first thing that pops up in Google. Because I think I've said this before in other podcasts, but there's a lot of people who pay to manipulate search results so that they can show up higher. So misinformation is constantly bubbling up to the top of search results. Now, Google does a pretty good job trying to combat that and trying to, you know, wipe out the people who kind of abuse the system. But you got to be warned that that's something that exists. So you can't just trust it. Now, if you're doing research for school, there's often resources that they provide. It used to be LexisNexis or NexisLexis or LexisMercedes or something like that. They used to have, you know, that was a good starting point. I mean, you go to your campus library, and I'm sure you'll find a librarian who's willing to tell you what's a good resource, especially online or in book form. You know, I remember having professors that told me that I could only use books and I couldn't use the internet for whatever reason, but it was a good exercise and good experience. So I would, you know, find physical books where I could cite something from them that was, you know, along the lines of whatever the paper I was writing was about. So that's probably, you know, your the first step. I mean, the library is a good source, I think, for anybody, but a lot of times it really only applies, well, not a lot of times, but I sometimes hesitate. I don't know if the information stays as fresh. The internet evolves so fast or grows information so fast that I often think that the libraries these days are going to have a hard time keeping up with the freshest information. And what I mean is something more specific, like if you're researching a job, you know, that could, the information there could change pretty rapidly. And it also might not even be available in the library. But if you're researching the history of something, and by all means, I think the library is a great resource, because you might find periodicals or books or, you know, different sources of information in the library that you just won't find as easily on the internet. You know, and there's an initiative to essentially try and digitize the entire world, the entire written world, which Google was spearheading at one point, you know. And I don't know if you know this or have recognized this, but whenever you do those CAPTCHAs, before, when you were doing the CAPTCHAs and you had to type out what you saw in the picture, a lot of times that was actually helping digitize books, because they kind of built it into the system so that every time you were typing what you saw in the picture, sometimes that picture was snippet, you know, a screenshot-ish type thing from books, old books, and you were actually helping to digitize old, you know, materials and make them available online for Google. And it was kind of a genius approach, because obviously reCAPTCHAs or the CAPTCHAs were or are still very important for fighting against spam. And it just kind of always blew my mind, because I don't think people realized what they were typing, something that was actually helping Google, you know, create the digital master archive. But now it's pictures. So I know this is off topic, but now you're actually helping train AI. Because every time you do a recapture and it says, pick out all the buses or pick out all the bicycles or pick out all the stoplights, you know, you're actually helping train artificial intelligence engines to actually recognize what a stoplight is or a bicycle or a person or a bus is. So that's my little tangent on that. And if you care to research that a little bit further, be my guest, because it's kind of fascinating how there's a lot of ways that AI is being trained in this day and age that we're actually contributing to it unknowingly to some degree, unless you did a little reading on it, which I tend to do because I'm just a nerd like that. Anyways, so back to research. Now, first let me go through the basics, the stuff that you'd actually be told by your professor, like what are the steps, the basic steps in the research process. You know, I think the key thing is you really need to focus your attention on the topic and really think it through. So, okay, you've done that. You know, you're identifying and you're developing the topic. That's your step one. You're writing it down. I think sometimes it's helpful. Physically write it down or type it out in a note app like Evernote, or I use Samsung Notes and Evernote as apps. I think iPhone just has the Notes app. You could do it there. But type it out. Start formulating your thoughts. You know, you start writing it down and say, okay, I want to research the different cancer hospitals that are across the United States because I just found out that my, relative has cancer, and I'm interested to know if there's anything out there that might be of useful nature to her, so, or him. So, you may want to do that. And so, okay, I'm written down that I'm going to start by researching the top 10 cancer hospitals in the United States. And then you start expanding that search. You want to say, okay, I'm going to expand that so I can see what are the top 10 in the world. Now, how many of the top 10 in the world are in the United States, right? So that's kind of why you start down a path, but you're just getting your basic idea of what you're going to research. Now, you're formulating the questions, really, I think is a good way to put it. Like, what are the questions I have? Like, well, what are the best cancer hospitals in the country? Okay, so that's your first step. Okay, so now I know what the best cancer hospitals are in the country. Now I want to know, what are the costs associated? Do they offer free services because, they're funded by donations? I think, the Mayo Clinic. I can't even think of any, but I know I've seen celebrities pimping out. Being pimped out? No. Sponsoring or endorsing? That's the word. Celebrities endorsing different hospitals, because if you see a celebrity doing it, then it must mean it's a good place. And you don't need to even do any research because you just saw the celebrity was in the commercial. Why would they lie to me? Why would somebody pay them to lie to me? So that would be one of the questions if you're researching why celebrities can, dupe people so easily. Anyways, I think if I get back on track, because I lost my train of thought as my train of thought just derailed, but what I am essentially getting at is you got to just try to figure out what is the list of questions you want to ask. So that's your first thing. And, step two is doing preliminary research for information. So, maybe you need to start off with what's a good source for finding the locations, That's where you probably do that cursory preliminary search in Google, and then it takes you off and maybe WebMD or the National Institute for Health, maybe those are sites that you branch off from Google, and then they have their own search engine, and you can start searching directly within their database of information. So and then Google just says something random, which might be because I said Google so many times and I have a Google Home Mini that was listening, apparently, which is always listening, and thought maybe that I needed help researching something. So that's why you just heard Mrs. Google or Ms. Google. I don't think she has a husband because Siri's... Oh, wait a second. Maybe. I don't know. I don't want to speculate. But anyway, so I said Google. Okay. Google is a good starting point. You end up on the National Institute of Health website. Now you search there. Now maybe they have a good list of the different locations ranked. But you can't just assume that that's the best source. So you say, okay, well, I'll go to WebMD. I'll go back to Google and then find other sites and maybe end up back on WebMD, or you go directly to WebMD. But, you know, that's your second source. I think a lot of journalists have the notion that three sources is the golden number for calling it, you know, verified. I don't know. I might be making that up. I could have sworn I heard Malcolm Gladwell say that. So it could be a good guide for you to say, okay, I want to find three solid resources that I can find that I will trust, you know, that the information is solid enough. And for something that's maybe not super important because, you know, you're going to end up calling those places anyways and doing your own, like, interviewing, you know, to make your own decision. So, you know, maybe you just need to know, okay, what is the top list? So maybe just get a list of all those places. You get the top 10, and then you just start making phone calls, and you don't need to go and find that WebMD has the same exact list, but just in a slightly different order or something. But anyways, you know, I think that, you know, that's essentially what you're trying to gauge as your starting point for building your solid sources and building and finding the solid information, you know, and it's actually, you know, step three is locate materials. Okay, cover that. Step four, evaluate your process. You know, evaluate your sources. At the end, you should evaluate your process and do a retrospective personally. So you evaluated your sources by just checking them against other sources. So, you know, three places said it was true, so you can feel fairly confident, you know. And I think, you know, then you're just kind of creating your notes, which you want to capture from what you were researching so that you can save it, you know. Like, it's going to be hard to remember all that information that you had and then also digest it. So, you know, write it down in some form, type it out, physically handwrite it, whatever. So I think that's probably what's important. And then, you know, write your letter to your relative, which is like writing your paper, which is the, you know, last step essentially would be to write your paper. Well, one of the last steps, you know. I think if you look at the main takeaway from those things is it's important to just find those sources in a way that makes you feel comfortable with the information that you've gleaned, you know. So I think if you kind of like start it off every time with that basic approach, you know, for doing doing your research, then I think you've got a solid approach. Now, most people who've gone to school and gone through, you know, grade school, college, whatever, have already kind of lived through this in some form, you know, so this is just a refresher. But I think what's important is first, you know, taking that initiative to actually go and do the research could be the first step. I want to find a new job. Okay, I've said it 100 times and everybody around me is annoyed because I haven't actually done it. Start by just researching. It doesn't mean you're committing to actually finding a new job, because that is a pretty big step for somebody to take and there's inherent risks behind it. So you look at it as a baby step, you know, as a stepping stone to finding a new job, doing your research. Again, you're starting on the internet and you're at Google and you're digging around and you're finding similar jobs to what you have in the companies. And then, you know, I think what's important is think of all the factors that you want to assess in a new job. Okay, what do they pay? What are the benefits? Where are they located? You know, are they a good company to work for? Are they awarded some for, you know, being inclusive or having diverse workforces? Are they accessible to the disabled? Stuff like that. I mean, I think that's all stuff that you need to factor, you know? And then you can go on sites like Glassdoor.com, or you can go on Payscale.com. Indeed has research available. CareerBuilder, Monster.com, the old school original job sites. You can you can go to any of these sites, and they have blogs essentially that will get you a starting point, you know, or maybe provide you the information. I know Glassdoor is great for finding out salaries and comparing salaries. It's also a great place to find comparative information about the salaries and comparative information that's actually reviews from current or past employees telling you what they think of the place. You know, they could be saying, hey, I left here and it was a great place to work, but their bonuses sucked. Or, you know, this was a great place to work, but they had no 401k. So, you know, I was getting paid great, but I had no setup for retirement. So that could be a problem. So you got to consider a lot of that stuff, you know. And I think it's important, obviously, to do your due diligence, to do that research before trying to find a job. You know, maybe it's bigger than just like trying to find a new job. You want to start a new business. Now, you know, the next kind of segue I want to put into this, because I've actually found that the side hustle episode that I did is got a lot of traction, and I think a lot of people are interested in trying to find ways to make money on the side, start, you know, side businesses. And one of the ways, you know, I mentioned in that podcast, I also mentioned in Building Your Online Business Identity podcast, that was episode 10 and 11. In those two episodes, I did mention, you know, how you got to start or how you can get started and get these businesses up and running. But there's actually a step that's before that, which is doing market research. You know, I mean, you've got a good idea. I want to do t-shirts. You can go give it a try, but you're going to have a lot better luck if you actually go out and you do your research on what you're trying to sell or, you know, offer as a service. So market research is very important. You know, one of the big things that's really, really popular nowadays in work environments. When I say work environments, I am speaking about companies and, you know, I guess what's becoming a good standard practice in the company is to have user research being conducted on a regular basis. And, you know, mainly that's because there's a real big need for understanding your customers. And there's a really big need to understand them, because otherwise, how are you really sure if you've just got, you know, teams of people who are always looking at the product, they're always looking at it. How do you know what they're building is really what the user wants? So user research is very important. Now, in that same vein as it being important for a company, it could be important for you. You know, I mentioned personally because if you think about the fact that you might be looking for a new job or something like that, you know, but also if you want to get that side hustle going, and like I mentioned, you know, you could just get the t-shirts up and running and kind of throw some wet t-shirts at the wall and see if those wet t-shirts stick, or if they, you know, maybe you could have, you could have a contest where you throw wet t-shirts at the wall and see if they stick and call it a wet t-shirt contest. That would be cool. So what I'm saying, though, is maybe a little research could go kind of far. And I can tell you from my experience, what it usually shows is, you know, some things that might just surprise you, some user behaviors that you may not have expected, how people would naturally interact with your product. You make assumptions but until you actually do that user research, doesn't really come to light. And so you might be surprised to find out that all your customers want tank tops, or all your customers want hoodies or long sleeve shirts, and maybe only like 10% of your customers actually like t-shirts. You know, maybe you got a bunch of people who, when they buy t-shirts, they prefer buying a t-shirt and a hat. So you got an opportunity to sell combinations, you know, to upsell a hat after they buy a t-shirt, you know? So, I mean, those are kind of opportunities that you're looking at. And it's important to understand your customers. Now, in terms of how to conduct this research, it's hard to do it as, you know, I want to say like a private citizen or a civilian, you know, a civvy, because you're not equipped to run the user tests like a big company is. I mean, big companies have big budgets that, you know, because it's in their best interest to understand users so they can constantly change and pivot or whatever. But as a personal person, you know, sometimes you're just going to pull your friends. Sometimes you just need to get out on the streets, you know, and do the sidewalk interviews in a matter of speaking. You know, ask family and friends, ask strangers, get, you know, an unofficial poll going as to whether it would make sense to continue down a path with whatever product it is, you know. I know sometimes people are just paranoid that someone's going to come around and steal their brilliant ideas, and they just want to get funding in secret somehow. And, you know, realistically, if you want somebody to invest in your product idea or your company, you got to present something to them that makes them feel good about whatever it is you're trying to pitch them. So if you could actually walk up to an investor and you can say, I did a survey and I found out that, you know, X number of people out of this survey, so you polled 100 people and, you know, 90% of these people said, man, I really wish they sold t-shirts where they weren't t-shirts, or, yeah, that sounds weird, like a shirt, I guess I'm imagining a shirt that comes down just 3 inches past your elbow towards your forearm and not short as like up to your, you know, your shoulder. Like they just want longer t-shirts, sleeves, is what I'm getting at. And 90% of your customers said they would buy that, you know, or potential customers. So if you had that kind of information and they, you know, and polled them and they were going to pay more too, they were willing to pay more, then just think of how powerful that statement could be to a potential investor. So right there, you could see the value of doing research just by the fact that it could potentially land you somebody who's willing to invest in your company. Now, some other ways that, like, I found, you know, I ran a Twitter poll a couple weeks ago just to see, you know, what people thought about episode ideas, you know, and public speaking ended up being the biggest one. And I made an episode of public speaking the next episode that I did. And, you know, I actually promoted it. I actually clicked on the button to promote the tweet. And I think it cost me maybe $10, and I got, I think I got about 50 who actually responded, but, you know, a few thousand people saw it. I mean, not that that matters much. It really only matters that people respond or do some kind of clicking on it. But, you know, I had 50 people who responded to that, you know, for about $10. Like, that's kind of a simple example. But it told me, hey, I've got some users that would really like to learn about public speaking. I mean, it was close to 50% of the 50 people, you know, so 25 people really wanted to hear about public speaking. And then, you know, the other 25 were divided, you know, 10 to meditation and, or no, I think it was actually 12 to meditation and the other 13 to exercise, or vice versa. Meditation basically came in second, in other words. Yeah, so let's just say for easy math, 15 people wanted meditation and 10 people wanted exercise. And I haven't done an episode on exercise yet because I haven't quite figured out what I'm going to do for that. So, needless to say, I took the advice, the number one option, you know, that people were screaming for, and I made the public speaking episode because this is a product in essence that I'm delivering to consumers of it, and I'm going to give people what they want to hear. And that's why I'm always screaming, saying, hey, you know, reach out to me, findingyouridentitypodcast@gmail.com or @FY_identity @Twitter. And you got YouTube where you can leave comments. I mean, I'm always looking for feedback, but that's also, you know, some conventional ways of getting your users to speak to you and to do, you know, some research is just asking for feedback. You know, that's a powerful thing this day and age, is just asking for feedback. I mean, you look at a video and getting, you know, 100 likes and 100 dislikes probably isn't a good thing. But if you get 100 likes and 10 dislikes, then you're probably onto something. The content has got some kind of quality that people are enjoying, you know? So I think that's important to understand that and be able to differentiate, you know, the different types of ways of doing research. Now, while I was doing research on researching research and creating a paradox and almost causing the whole world to disappear into a black hole, but while I was doing that, it dawned on me that it may be useful to some people to know that you can actually get a job in doing research professionally. And, you know, some of the numbers that I came across and Indeed had, you know, some baseline average salaries, which were around $75,000 a year. But they did say that, you know, some researchers could make as much as $120,000 a year, which is a nice chunk of money to just use Google. No, I'm pretty sure that the ones making the high dollars actually have to do a little bit more thorough research, and probably not a ton of Google results are going to help them. It could be that that's where they start, but most likely it's going to be from them, you know, running surveys and polls and, you know, digging pretty deep into the subjects that they're looking into. But you can also work as a freelance researcher, which I found, you know, apparently there's a site called wonder.com or something like that, but it's called Wonder. And, you know, the thing that I saw was that, you know, this was a kind of a side hustle. But not really, because it was mentioning that if you worked about 35 hours a week, you can make about $2,000 a week. And, you know, I mean, I guess that's pretty decent money there doing it freelance, but I don't know how consistent that would be. I don't know if it's always 35 hours a week, or generally you work 35 hours a week, but, or I mean, 35 hours total over the course of a month, you know, so maybe it's not all in 1 week, but, you know, just a thought, freelancing it, side hustling it, you know, could be something. I mean, some of the stuff I saw, you know, in terms of user research, you could be on the end where you're collecting, you know, so you could be taking surveys, or you could be filling out reviews of products, you know, secret shoppers. You know, those used to come into some of the restaurants that I worked at. And it was always funny because it seemed that we always knew, or somebody always knew, the secret shoppers. So it wasn't very secretive. Although there was one time when one had left and they turned in their report or something, but somebody found out and was like shocked because it was like, oh my gosh, like that was a secret shopper. And they used to matter, especially in the corporate restaurants, because that stuff filters all the way up to the top. They care about what that one secret shopper says versus, you know, the 100 or so people that eat in there every night and seem to be fine and happy. But, you know, I think that's one of the cautionary tales of user research. You can't just completely trust it 100% as you know, the authority on the matter. You know, it's again probably worth conducting the research or the tests or the polling or whatever surveys in a couple different ways and trying to see if the conclusions make sense collectively. But, you know, so you can actually do that as a career if you so wanted to. And, you know, it might be something interesting to work as a side hustle too, a side gig. But I thought that was interesting. Now, I also kind of thought of doing this episode because I started to do some research on something completely random. And, you know, I think I had mentioned that I pretty much am addicted to gum since I quit smoking. And I mentioned that in the Breaking Habits episode, which was episode 3, I believe. And I mentioned that I essentially replaced smoking cigarettes with gum. So I chew a lot of gum. And my gum of choice is Orbit gum. And it's specifically the peppermint Orbit gum, which I just love. Like, I mean, I don't even know if I love it anymore. I think it's just I need it, so I just chew it all the time. But I look at the package, and I've always noticed that it said it had phenylalanine in it. And what's kind of funny about that is, you know, it's got a thing prefacing it that says it's phenylketonutrix or something to that effect. I can't even pronounce it, but I can say phenylalanine fine because I've seen the word plenty of times. But it's essentially this essential amino acid, which I always find is a funny word, an amino acid. Like, it makes me think it's like amine acid or something, that it does harm, but it's actually good for your body. Necessary, in fact. It's what helps build protein, the proteins that your body needs. But anyway, so I decided I'm going to look into this just to see, you know, a little bit more details about this. Now, things have come up in the past about it because phenylalanine is in diet sodas. And so people always, you know, worry, like, is that going to kill me, cause cancer or something like that? But it really isn't bad. It's actually good. It's actually essential because it's an amino acid that your body doesn't produce naturally. So you actually need it, and you need to get it in some form, but usually you get it from food substances. Now, there's really not a ton in the gum, but you are getting a little bit from it. So that's kind of interesting. But, you know, it's funny just because I think people get paranoid about stuff. Like, aspartame is also in it. Aspartame is in one of those artificial sweeteners. I think it's Equal or Sweet and Low, or I think both of them actually make one that has aspartame in it, and versus the saccharin or whatever the other alternative one is. But I always find it not amusing, but it always had come up when I was younger that was like saccharin causes cancer, and then it was aspartame, you know, and then it's phenylalanine. Like, you know, everything's probably killing us. The sun is killing us. It's kind of caused skin cancer, and you can die from skin cancer. You know, everything around us is killing us. So, I mean, not to say that you should go out and drink bleach, because that will definitely kill you. And as a disclaimer, do not drink bleach. But, you know, it's just one of those interesting things to me that, you know, people get paranoid about stuff. But I was looking up, I went on to this website called Healthline, and when I started looking up the article, what I noticed was it actually broken it up into these summary tabs. I'll read the summary. Phenylalanine is an essential amino acid that is used to produce proteins and signaling molecules. It has been studied as a treatment for several medical conditions, but is dangerous for those with a specific genetic disorder. And that was a summary. So in terms of doing user research, sometimes all you need is, you know, a summary or the abstract of something in order to kind of glean enough information about the topic, you know. And in this one, I could kind of skip to the summary. So I can skip to the next summary, which helps sum up some the next section, which the next section was titled, "It's Important for Normal Functioning of Your Body." And the summary was, phenylalanine can be converted to an amino acid tyrosine, which is then used to produce important signaling molecules. These molecules are involved in aspects of your body's normal functioning, including your mood and stress responses. So I looked at the section, probably about six paragraphs, and I just skipped to the summary and I get the gist of it. And I can kind of move on to the next section, which is maybe beneficial for certain medical conditions. And, you know, this summary says that it may be useful in treating some kind of skin disorder called vitiligo, something like that. It's vitiligo, which is probably more fun to spell than say. Evidence does not provide strong support for the effectiveness of this amino acid in treating other conditions, though limited high-quality research has been conducted. So they haven't really done enough to really prove that it works anywhere else other than treating that one skin condition. Then the next section is side effects. And the summary there is, it's considered safe in quantities found in normal foods. Individuals with a disorder called phenylketonuria cannot metabolize this amino acid and must minimize consumption due to serious health consequences. That was the word I was looking for, that phenylketonuria, because I think on the package of Orbitz it says phenylketonurix, and that's to indicate that it's that it contains phenylalanine, and somebody who has that PKU is the acronym, has that disorder, should actually stay away from it. So that's why it was bold, and that's why it stood out to me, and that's what led me down the path of researching what the heck it was. And now I've educated you a little bit on what phenylalanine is. And it also brings us to the end of this episode of Finding Your Identity. And I'm encouraging everyone to do their research and research whatever you want, whatever comes to mind. Research the world. It's all part of learning, right? And it's an education. Everything is a part of educating yourself and growing your brain and you know, expanding your knowledge of everything in the world and universe around you. And I think, you know, positive things will come from doing your research, you know, research what your identity could be and find it. And also watch the YouTube video first few minutes and see what you might be able to get for free in terms of merch. So thanks for listening again to Finding Your Identity. And until next time, take care.